I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. This is a surprise stream. I am no less surprised than you. I thought of it very, very recently, and I asked my friend Millennial Woes if he'd like to join me. And the goal of this is simply for us to discuss some of our pet peeves in English grammar and diction that we commonly encounter when within our own sphere. And the goal is to make us better masters of English, whether it's our native language or our second or third language. We're going to be more effective as a movement, as a milieu, if we have greater mastery of our own language or of the English language in general. So, Woes, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for inviting me. One thing I would add to what you just said is being able to express yourself clearly and articulately not only makes you more effective in the obvious way, it also makes you more persuasive because people realize, oh, this is actually somebody with a brain between their ears. It's something that people might underestimate, I think. Now, I'm not saying that it means that you will win every argument, far from it, but people will at least know that they can't just dismiss you and they can't talk down to you.
Yeah, and of course, you have these people out there who will affect this sort of strained looking for the little poison pill, anything that they can use to dismiss you, right? And
absolutely.
If you misuse one word, they'll dismiss you. And it's a little game that people play. I don't play that game. I have contempt for it. But still, it's a little game that you can deny them the pleasure of by just using language more correct. I'm being ironic there. So making less mistakes. Grammar. Let's just jump into this. And folks, if you're out there and you would like to ask questions, throw in your comments, share your pet peeves, linguistic errors, and things like that, we're welcoming them. You can do them at Entropy. You can do them at Odyssey. You can do them at DLive. You can do them in the comments. You can wrap a little bit of a donation around it, of course. We very much appreciate that. But I really want this to be a pleasant, fun stream, not the two of us scolding you out there. So let's just begin. I want to begin with one that I see all the time in our own circles, including people who are really good writers. There are a couple of really good writers in our sphere that I've published at Countercurrents, and I've had to correct their misuse of the word cliche. The word cliche, just cliche, C-L-I-C-H-E, with a little accent on the E, cliche is a noun. And yet I commonly see people in our sphere using cliche as an adjective or an adverb. So they'll say, this cliche sitcom. No, that's the wrong use of cliche. If you're using cliche as an adjective or an adverb, like cliche to modify sitcom, it's cliched with a D. So just to say cliche is to use a noun, and you can't use a noun without modifying it as an adverb or an adjective. So that's my first one that comes to mind.
Wow. And you're disagreeing with Commander Riker from Star Trek, The Next Generation. I just
really
want to let you know that. Oh, yes, because on at least one occasion, he uses the word in that way.
Well, I think he's wrong.
Yeah, okay.
I just think he's wrong. Even Commander Riker, even Commander Data be wrong to use a cliche in that way. But anyway, so that's my first. So what's your first? What's the first one on your list?
Well, I made a rather long list. The first one that just comes to mind is there is versus there are. And I think this annoys me. It grinds my gears so much because I see it every day or hear it every day. It's when people will say something like, there's three apples. There's four apples. It just annoys me so much.
Yeah, it's basic subject-verb agreement.
You know, I'm perhaps more amenable than you are, possibly, I don't know, to the prospect of language simply evolving. And some things I think are perhaps just lost causes, which it's not the hill to die on. But there are some things that are are just egregious. And I think that this one is probably a lost cause, in the same way that the word whom is antiquated now. And I wish it weren't, but I think it is. And with theirs and there are, most people just say theirs, whether they're mm-hmm. talking singular or plural. One thing that I would add to this is the contraction therer. Yeah. I hate that. I don't know why anyone would ever bother to do that. It's just less clear. Anyway, there we
go. Well, if you follow a rule of minimizing contractions in your written work, you generally will avoid subject-verb disagreements yes. that pop up like that. So it's really in spoken English that you'll hear that. And I cringe when I hear that. That's wrong.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people might well think this is just ridiculous. This is anal. But the thing is, it does matter to someone who knows about this stuff. So, well, to anyone who knows about this stuff, you signal to them that you are not as literate, not as articulate as they are. So why not just avoid doing that? Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. It's not that much extra effort. Well, certainly once it's run in, once you're habituated to it. So, I mean, why not just sound better?
Yeah, why not say it right? Or is it rightly? Yes, you must say it rightly. But anyway, my second that I would like to put people on notice with, and again, intelligent people who have sent articles to Countercurrents, who, although this one person hasn't sent articles in years, but even an intelligent person who used to write for Countercurrents would use bourgeoisie as an adjective. They would refer to a bourgeoisie conservative. And that's a misuse of the term. Bourgeoisie refers to the middle class. It's or the upper middle class. It's a French term, obviously. It's a noun. It refers to the bourgeois or the bourgeoisie, the upper middle class. Now, if you want to use a form of bourgeois to describe something, to use it as an adjective or an adverb or something, the proper use is just bourgeois, a bourgeois conservative, or bourgeois cowardice, bourgeois greed.
Yeah, it's things like that. Bourgeois is the describe. So it's the bourgeois person, the bourgeoisie. Bourgeoisie is the noun. I think this is easy to remember. It's just a bad habit that people get into.
So what's the second on your list?
Now, this is strictly in the written word. It's when people write it's with an apostrophe when they mean when for the possessive pronoun. So it should not have an apostrophe there. It's not a big deal, but again, it's the kind of thing that does make a difference if the reader knows about these things. So again, I would say possessive pronouns never have apostrophes. So hers, theirs, and whose. Whose is different. It's with an E at the end. And it's the same with its.
Yeah, that's a good way of remembering it. None of the other possessives have apostrophes. So,
yeah. It's with an apostrophe always is short for it is.
Yeah.
So, or it has occasionally. Otherwise, it means possessive pronoun.
Right. That's a good one. A third one for me, and this is again something that intelligent people in our own sphere commonly misuse, is the phrase begging the question. People will say Biden's inarticulacy begs the question of whether he's in cognitive decline, right? And they use the phrase begs the question basically as equivalent to raises the question or prompts the question or leads one to wonder whether or not he's in cognitive decline, something like that. So people will say, instead of raises the question or suggests the question or prompts the question, they'll say begs the question. And one could almost give up on this, and maybe in a couple of decades people will. But the truth is that begs the question or begging the question is actually the name of a logical fallacy. It's another term for arguing in a circle. And if you've taken a basic class in logic, you know that begs the question means that. A lot of people still take logic and critical thinking. And so if you misuse begs the question, people will think he doesn't know his basic logic or whatever. And so it's something you shouldn't misuse. Also, there are certain contexts where you might misuse that in a way that it actually makes it hard to understand what you're trying to say, because people might actually wonder, is he saying that there's a circular argument here, or is he just misusing the term? And so that just creates a certain amount of confusion. It can create objective confusion about what you're saying, but also simply by misusing the term, you make people think, well, this guy didn't take logic. You know, he's not to be taken seriously or something like that. It's just a subtle way that people will downgrade you, and often unjustly, because like I said, I know intelligent and educated people who misuse it all the time.
This is a real problem with everyone under the age of 60. And it gets worse with each generation. There are perfectly intelligent Zoomers, intelligent Zoomers. I don't want to say they couldn't string a sentence together, but they sound less intelligent than they are, because they have never been taught these things. Now, it's undoubtedly the same with my own generation as well, but I think it's even worse with Zoomers. Yeah. It's a serious thing. It really does affect how you come across.
Yeah. The origin of the phrase begging the question comes from basically academic debates about arguments. So, for instance, if you want to prove that Socrates is mortal, okay, you could construct an argument. And say you're in a debate with somebody and you're going to defend the thesis Socrates is mortal. And so you say to your opponent, will you grant me the premise that Socrates is a man? Will you grant it to me? Will you, you know, it's another way of saying, I'm begging you, I'm asking you to grant this premise, right? You can ask people to grant premises. You can say, okay, I grant that Socrates is a man. Do you grant that all men are mortal? And they say, yes, all men are mortal, and Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal, right? It's perfectly legitimate for you to ask your opponent to grant certain premises if you're trying to lead him to a conclusion. But if you ask him to grant the conclusion, you know, do you grant that Socrates is mortal? No, that's the question. And you're begging the question. You have to give me an actual argument for that conclusion. And if you don't give me an argument for the conclusion, but somehow just assume that it's true or ask the other person to grant that it's true without an argument, you're cheating. So that's how the term originally comes about. And it stuck around for a long time, but it has a technical meaning in logic. And when you misuse that phrase, begging the question or begs the question, it just creates confusion. So what's the next on your list, Woz?
It's more mundane than that, I'm afraid. It's when people say, eat healthy, it just, this calls for an adverb because you're describing a verb. So the correct word is healthily, eat healthily. And again, I understand that at this point, maybe it's the horse is bolted, but nonetheless, it does sound better. Whenever I hear someone saying eat healthy, not that I object to the advice, but the grammar is just awful. Eat healthily. I know it sounds a bit more onerous, but it sounds more authoritative because it is correct.
Yeah, well, you know, when people say, how are you doing? Many people say good. You know, I'm good.
That's an Americanism. It's crept over to Britain by now.
But good is technically not the right term. You're doing well. But that's something that is really, I think the horse is bolted on that. Because there are certain things where you, if you say them correctly, it sounds wrong, right?
Yes, and yes. If you say at this stage, we're so accustomed to the wrong version.
Yeah. If you say something that's correct and sounds wrong, it actually interrupts the flow of conversation and it has the opposite effect of making you seem educated. It makes you seem eccentric or odd. So sometimes the perfect grammar, especially in casual spoken discourse, really isn't the right thing to do. For instance, there are questions about how to pronounce foreign words, right? There's a Dutch historian, Johan, And his last name is spelled Huizinga. And English speakers will look at that and they'll say, oh, Huizinga? That seems like the right way of saying it. And in English academia, I've only heard it as Huizinga. But the Dutch pronounce the H-U-I as how. But if you said Johan Huizinga, people would actually look at you askance in America because they think you got it wrong, or they think you're being pretentious, right? It's like pronouncing Van Gogh, Van Gogh, or something like that. In English, you know, we pronounce it Van Gogh, and if you pronounce it Van Gogh, people look at you like you're being pretentious, or they think you're ignorant. So there's certain levels of correctness and precision that are actually somehow wrong. And so that's just a matter of tact, figuring out when being precise or correct is actually the wrong thing to do.
I would err on the side of just saying it properly, and if other people take issue with it, it's their problem.
Yeah. That's good. One thing that I don't think we can just give up on and say, well, the horse is out of the barn, are Latinate and Greek plurals and singulars.
I always get tripped up with referenda and referendums. So
When people use the word data as a singular, it's wrong. Data is a Latin plural, and the singular is datum. Okay, and there are times when it just sounds grating. It's the same when people use the word phenomena as a singular, when it should be phenomenon.
Do you know who does this? It's quite amazing. It's Jordan Peterson.
Okay, well, he's an educated man, and he does,
Even he does the it's an interesting phenomena. I'm not going to do his voice, but there you go. Phenomenon is the singular. Phenomena is plural, multiple phenomena.
Data are multiple, and so you should never use it as a singular word. Media is a plural word, and if you want to use a singular version of it, it's medium. Criteria is a plural word, right? If you say, this is an outdated criteria, no. It would be criterion. That's the singular. And these things, you hear this from college graduates, you hear this from newscasters, you hear this from college professors, popular authors, but it's still grating. And if they catch themselves, they get embarrassed. So we shouldn't do that.
Absolutely. Again, as I said at the start, even if it's something subtle, if you can say it correctly, why not? Because it will bulletproof you against petty point scoring.
Yeah, that's an interesting phenomena. Yeah, exactly. That's kind of surprising from Jordan Peterson. He's written how many books and given how many thousands of hours of lectures and, you know, things like that happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's strange. I think a lot of people have a certain weakness. I always get tripped up by principal and principal.
That's the next one on my list, actually.
Oh.
Yes,
right.
But what's on yours? What's your next item?
Well, there are quite a few. For her and me. Now, that is actually correct. It happened to both her and me. That is correct. But because people are so accustomed to thinking that it should always be I, it sounds incorrect. People will think it should be for her and I, or for she and I. But no.
Just between you and I.
Yes, exactly.
People think it sounds more sophisticated, but it's actually improper.
Yes, this probably happened because primary school teachers 40, 50 years ago didn't know any better, and they started telling pupils that it's always and I. And now it's just become completely ingrained. Now, there's an easy way to get this right. Just remove the other person from the sentence.
Yeah.
And then it's because you would never say it was for I. Obviously, you would never say that. And so if you remove the other person, you can see which is the correct word. And then it's for her and me. And also, you would never say I did it for she. Of course, he would never say that.
He would say
I did it for her. So it's for her and me. And between you and me, it's never between I. That's no, absolutely not. And it's the same with the opposite, which let me think for her and me. She and I went to the shop.
Yeah.
That is correct.
Yeah.
Because she went to the shop and I went to the shop.
Right.
But you would never say me went to the shop. I mean, for God's sake.
you could, but you would be Jar Jar Binks or something.
Yeah, but this is the thing. It's increasingly common now for people to say, me and Jack went to the shop.
Right.
And it just grinds my gears so much. It's just remove the other person or yourself and see which is the correct word. And it's very simple when you do that. That's the way to get this right.
That's the rule. So we have a few witticisms here to share. So it's Commander Datum on Star Trek, then, since he is a singular.
We'll have to ask Riker.
Riker will tell us. And Nick says, so actually it's Withnal and Me? No?
This is a thing.
You can begin a sentence, Withnal and I went to the country.
And they did.
And they did,
But if it were the story of Withnal and Me, I mean, really, it probably should be Withnal and Me. And this has actually been pointed out to the writer, Bruce Robinson. I'm sure he's talked about, he's addressed this. Yes, there we are.
Well, I actually think it's significant. In my review, I say that Withnal and I is better because Marwood, the I, is actually the agent in the film. He's the one who develops and takes control of his life. Whereas if this were being told from Withnal's perspective, Withnal being the guy on the way down who lacks agency, he would call it Marwood and Me because it would be the object form rather than the subject form. So I think there's maybe some meaning to it. And you can say Withnal and I,
Lived
in Camden Town.
Exactly. It's not necessarily incorrect. Withnal and I were always going to part ways.
Yeah.
You know, it could be the start of the story.
Yeah.
So it's not incorrect. And I do think it's more poetic sounding than Withnal and Me. Mm-hmm. And it should be, because it should sound poetic, because it's a lovely story.
It emphasizes at the end Marwood's agency. I mean, that's the dramatic character transformation in the film, is Marwood becoming more of an agent and taking control of his life.
Definitely.
All righty. Well, let me go back to my list here. Principal and principal. Principal with P-A-L versus principal, P-L-E. Basically, the distinction is this. A principal with a P-L-E at the end is a basic tenet of something, T-E-N-E-T,
not a tenant. That's later on my list.
However, a principal, P-A-L, could be your tenant if he is a school principal, right? But a principal, P-L-E, refers to some kind of starting point, some premise, an axiom, or whatever. The first principle, right? Whereas when you use principal, P-A-L, it has a sense of something that presides, something that's first.
Something that has primacy.
Yeah. And that would include the principal of the school. And one little mnemonic that people use, and that's mnemonic, not memnonic. One little mnemonic is the principal of the high school is your pal. He's your friend, P-A-L. So remember him as your friend, even though he might not be, and you'll be able to distinguish between principal and principal. And that's something that's often confused. One of my best writers still gets principal and principal confused for some reason. Mm. I hope he's listening. He might not even know who he is. But anyway, it is one of those things where people just slip up.
It happens to me.
Yeah.
It's one that I've got to be more conscious of that.
And they can sort of blend together. So for instance, principal, P-A-L, in the sense of primacy, well, you can have something that is the principle, the first principle, you know, the ultimate axiom of something. And so you could actually say that, you know, existence exists is the principle of Ayn Rand's philosophy or something.
Oh, dear.
Woe to you if you get those two mixed up, though, because anyway.
All right. So another one is, we alluded to this earlier, whom. Now, as I said, this is probably gone already. However, you can get it right. There is an easy rule to remember so that you will get it right. And it's this. So let's take an example. For whom was it made? For who was it made? The answer to that is it was made for him. So that's how you know it's for whom, because it's for him.
Whom is an object form, yes. And him is an object form.
And so is them as well. And these all end in M. Mm-hmm. So if you were to rearrange the sentence and the correct word would be him, then the correct word is whom. If the correct word would be he or they, then the correct word is who.
Who made this mess? He made this mess.
Exactly. Yeah. You would never say them made this mess.
Or yes, unless you're getting trannies involved, and then or feminists, and then language is just utterly it's mutilated. It's given hormones and then mutilated. Yes.
Yeah. So that's a good way to remember this. Who did this? He did this. For whom was it made? It was made for him. There you go.
The next on my list, I'm going to skip forward to, is enormity. When people use the word enormity, they almost often use it to refer to something big. The enormity of the mall. The enormity of the Vatican. But here's the thing. Enormity does not mean enormousness, largeness, or whatever. It means monstrousness or evil or wickedness. And so it's often very confusing. For instance, if you refer to the enormity of the Vatican, somebody might think, I guess this guy really doesn't like Catholics, right? Or the enormity of the mall, you think, well, I guess this person doesn't like the architecture or something like that. And so enormity, it refers to something that's bad or wicked or flagrant.
I had no idea about this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, okay. Oh.
And you can use it as a noun. You can say, how was the opera? And you can say, it was an enormity. Now, that's an odd use, but it just means a monstrous travesty, right? A mess, right? How would you characterize the Versailles Peace Conference?
And it was an enormity.
Yeah. So that's a useful word to mark, because people still know the actual meaning of it. And so oftentimes, if you use it in this natural but very wrong way, you can create, again, unclarity, confusion about what you're intending to say. But, you know, you can also just, you know, sound somewhat less educated than you really are.
So is it synonymous with monstrosity?
Yeah, exactly. And when I was a child, when I was 9 years old, I offended an uncle of mine by referring to the Parliament building as a monstrosity. Because
was it the Scottish Parliament building?
Well, there are many Parliament buildings that truly are monstrosities, but this wasn't one. This was actually a lovely Parliament building, but it was enormous. And I referred to it as a monstrosity. And he knew that I was just misusing the word, but he got very pedantic with me about it. He said, well, if you think it's a monstrosity, we won't return. If you think it's a monstrosity, I don't know why we bother taking you here, you know? And it was funny. So I learned that one when I was 9. But yeah, enormity and monstrosity are sort of used in the same way. They sound like they mean something very, very big, but actually they mean something very, very bad.
All right, well, I'll move on to another one of mine. When people erroneously repeat the word that, I'll give you an example. Do you think that if the Swedes were replaced, that the society such and such?
Right.
This is an increasingly common error, and there's no easy way to avoid it. You've just got to be careful. I don't really know why it happens, why it's taken off, but it really has. People do it all the time. And do you think that if the Swedes were replaced, that their society, etc.? No, you only need one there. So
yeah, that's interesting. I haven't noticed that. It's the kind of thing that you would find, I think, if people are creating long sentences. You know, especially if they're typing and creating long sentences, and they might repeat these things and not realize that there's an unnecessary word there. So that's interesting.
Yeah, I think it is basically a typo. I'm guessing it's usually a typo.
Another very commonly misused word is hopefully. Hopefully, I will finish my homework. When you say that, you're trying to say, I hope I will finish my homework. But what it literally means is, I will finish it full of hope, right? Hopefully, I will finish this. And so it just really should be used as I hope. When you're trying to say, I hope this happens, I hope we have nice weather today, I hope we have a good summer, just say that. Don't say hopefully. To do that, I think part of it is akin to passive voice, because it leads the person who's hoping, right? It takes you out of the picture oftentimes. Hopefully, it'll be a nice summer. Well, you should be saying, I hope. And there is a tendency in writing, especially bureaucratic writing and insecure writing, tentative writing, or deliberately obfuscatory writing, to remove responsibility. You have these clauses, these constructions with passive voice. Mistakes were made. Oh, whose mistakes? Things like that. Bureaucrats love to do that. You know, corporation men, the men in the gray flannel suits, you know, people in large organizations, nobody's really responsible. And so they will eliminate the I sometimes from their sentences. But generally, when people begin a sentence, hopefully, they really should just be saying, I hope such and such.
Right. Okay. Now, you mentioned this one earlier, less or fewer mistakes.
Yes.
If the thing can be counted, it should be fewer. If it is a homogeneous mass, then it's less.
Right.
That's the rule there.
Yeah. There was a famous ad, I think it was in the 80s. It had to be in the 80s. You know, Miller Lite has less calories, you know, and somebody sort of said, well, you know, Miller Lite has less taste, costs less, but it has fewer calories, right? And I just thought that was very funny how they were raked over the coals for that. So yeah, anyway, exactly. Less and few. That is an important distinction. And again, people will just sort of call you out on it, or they'll not call you out on it. They won't correct you. They'll just mentally dock you in their estimation when you mix those up.
Yes. Yes. That's your turn now.
This has to do with, I would say, sort of pretentiousness in language. Sometimes people will add extra vowels to terms. In Alabama, you're not an athlete, you're an athlete, right? And
right, that, I didn't know that. Scottish people sometimes say film instead of film. Mm-hmm. So similar thing maybe.
Yeah, I don't think it's pretentious in that case, it's just a regional variation. But sometimes it's fun to pad words out. And so people will say, we have a few interpretative differences with one another. They're talking about a film, and it's no, it's interpretive. Yeah. You can have an interpretation, but when you talk about your interpretive assumptions or your interpretive differences or something like that, it's you don't say interpretative.
Right. Another one people often get tripped up with is authoritative. It's difficult.
Yeah, exploitive. This was an exploitive relationship. You can talk about exploitation, but it's wrong to talk about this relationship being exploitative, right? And so what's happened is an extra syllable in a noun or related noun is being imported into the verbs. So interpretive becomes interpretative. Exploitive becomes exploitative. It's proper to talk about an orientation, you know, the orientation of the Parliament building in relationship to the river or something like that, right? but you become disoriented, or you need to orient yourself. You don't become disorientated or need to become orientated, right? And when you say it that way, it just sounds a little pretentious. Like you just want to swish that word around in your mouth a little bit longer, right? like you're being precious or being pretentious. So yeah, there is a tendency with some nouns that have an extra syllable in them to have that extra syllable creep into a related verb or adjective, right? An exploitive relationship is fine. You don't need to call it exploitative or interpretive differences, right? Interpretative, right?
Yeah, that's quite, I wasn't aware of this.
Okay. Maybe it only happens in America.
Maybe. Exploitative is the only one I've ever heard. I don't think I've ever heard exploitive. I just looked it up, and it does seem that that originally was the proper word.
Yeah.
But again, it's one of these things. Someone also sent me enormity, a dictionary definition, a screenshot, and I think the same thing. It now is taken to mean of large scale, but generally with a negative connotation. So hold on a second. The great or extreme scale or extent of something perceived as bad or morally wrong. Mm-hmm. And the example is, I thought a search disclosed the full enormity of the crime.
Yeah.
So there we go. Sort of half and half there. Okay, here's an obvious one, irregardless.
Yeah.
This is a conflation of regardless and irrespective,
which
both mean the same thing. And irregardless is thus a sort of double negative.
Yeah, irregardless it's kind of a pretentious thing. Another thing that's similar is competence and competency.
I believe
Thomas Sowell said that competency is competence as described by the incompetent, which I liked. But generally, if you're referring to somebody's mastery of a subject, you just talk about their competence. You know, when you talk about like an exam, you would talk about he's going to be taking his competency exam.
Competency is synonymous with ability, capability.
Yeah.
He has this capability. He has this competency. He has competencies in these areas. Whereas competence is the general quality of being capable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would you say that's an accurate summary?
Okay. Well, I'm looking at the Fowler's Modern English Usage. That urges confining competence to senses of ability and capacity, and the second as having to do with modest means. Now, I don't know about that, but there should be a large, shorter sounding words, frequent, usually take CY, frequency, and longer sounding words, innocent versus innocence. And then many words take CE in the singular and CIEs in the plural rather than CES. I'm irrelevance versus irrelevancies. I'm just getting off in the bushes here. But I have heard of competency exams, right? Whereas competence is your ability to do something. And generally, you should just talk about competence. I have heard the term competency tests.
It's weird. I've first encountered the word when the Brexit furore was going on. Mm-hmm. And they were saying that these particular competencies will be returned to Britain.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, so ability, capability isn't quite the right word. It's like the right to do this.
Knowledge, skills, abilities, behaviors. Yeah, so how to put it, they're components of an organization or of a nation, right? So you talk about competencies. Return to Britain means certain governmental functions
that were
taken over by the the state by the EU will now be coming back to Britain after Brexit. So, yeah. You know, a competency does refer to components of an organization, its functions and things like that, whereas competence refers to an ability, or you can talk about they questioned his competence to stand trial. I don't know if they would say questioned his competency to stand trial. That's actually interesting. But sometimes competence is enough. And a lot of times people will just embroider it with the CY.
If you're not sure which to use, use some synonym that you are more sure of.
Yeah.
That's generally a good way to avoid these mishaps.
Yeah. Yeah. What's next on your list?
Knowing when to use a comma and a full stop. This is something that I first noticed a long time ago, 2005, something mm-hmm. like that. And it's at this point, it's very ingrained. Again, especially with the Zoomers, I think they don't like full stops. I've been told this, that Zoomers are intimidated by...
zooming ahead.
They're intimidated by the use of full stops because to them it seems very formal and unfriendly. They're not accustomed to it. They're just accustomed to the sentence just sort of ending without formally ending. And so when you do use a full stop, it feels cold, apparently, to them. But the other thing is the use of commas. Commas have become a sort of default punctuation mark. So people will just use them to separate clauses without any regard, irregardless of how the clauses fit together. So the rule basically is this. If a set of clauses together form a coherent sentence, then put a full stop at the end of that. And whatever follows next should be a separate sentence, usually. That's the way to remember this.
Yeah,
And I would also say that it's worth doing this because the full stop means, okay, that's it, over now. That I can now, my brain can now process what I have just read.
Yeah.
So divide it into chunks for mental activity.
Yeah, yeah. Very good.
Your turn now.
Imply versus infer. These are misused a lot now. People will say...
He inferred that... Blacks are less intelligent.
Well, that's fine. You know, to infer means to draw a conclusion. Okay, but sometimes people will say infer when they mean imply. So they'll say that. I should have had an example.
In his speech, he inferred that such and such. He implied his audience inferred.
Right. He implied his audience inferred, right? That's good. That's a good way of remembering it. So, but people will often say, they will often use infer when they mean imply.
Yeah.
The premises inferred the conclusion. No. The premises implied the conclusion. The blood splattering on the walls a certain crime took place. No. It implied that a crime took place. However, you, the spectator or the investigator, might infer that an axe murder had taken place, right? You are inferring in your own mind, whereas the facts might imply or the premises might imply a certain conclusion, but drawing the conclusion is an act of inference.
Exactly. So to use the axe murderer thing, so when Wendy discovers Halloran's body with a huge gaping axe wound, she infers that Jack has been up to funny buggers.
It's very dark.
It is, but
I started it with the axe murder.
My mind went to The Shining.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, another one. And people asked me to address this one. Could care less. I don't know how this one came about. It's always, I couldn't care less. Well, I mean, sometimes you could, could care less about this, but luckily for you, I don't care. I care quite a bit about this thing.
Yeah, whatever.
No one ever is ever going to say that. It's, I couldn't care less. I care about this so little that I literally couldn't care any less about it than I do.
Yeah.
That's the point. So it's, I couldn't care less.
Right, exactly. Okay, that's good. That's a useful one. Another distinction that's important to make is between being disinterested and being uninterested. Disinterested means to be basically, how to put it, impartial, whereas to be uninterested could mean to be bored. So you would not say that I watched the new movie, The Batman, but I was disinterested halfway through, right? At 2 hours and 40 minutes, I became disinterested. No, that's wrong. You really mean that you became uninterested. You became bored with it. You didn't achieve objectivity about the film, right? At 2 hours and 40 minutes, you achieved boredom. So yeah, often to be disinterested is not to be uninterested. To be disinterested is to be above it, to be objective, etc.
Yeah, impartial.
Impartial,
I think
yeah.
that's the good way to remember this. Disinterested means you're not taking one side or the other.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Now, somebody asked me to address the word addicting. Now, I think this has emerged because the word addictive can annoyingly mean two different things. I have an addictive personality. I get addicted to things. Pistachio nuts are addictive. Once you have one, you can't stop. They are addictive. People get addicted to them. People get addicted to the thing that is addictive, especially people who are addictive. So this is an annoying ambiguity, and so I think people have sort of just invented the adjective addicting to
Yeah.
describe something that people get addicted to.
Yeah. I think addictive is enough.
I don't know. I can understand why people have done it. I wish there was a better way. I don't think that, see, to say I have an addictive personality, it does work. It does make sense. But to say that
Well, I
something is
mean,
addictive makes sense. So I don't know how this should be differentiated.
yeah, I think though that everybody understands that when you say, I have an addictive personality, that doesn't mean that people
People get
become
addicted to you.
get addicted to my personality, right? Maybe there are people who get addicted to other people's personalities. For instance, I think that Nick Fuentes has an evidently addictive personality because people are willing to listen to him go on and on and on and on, right? So he's got to be addictive in that sense. But yeah, usually when you talk about an addictive personality, you're talking about a personality that is, how to put it, inclined to pick up addictions. Yeah.
Yes,
Yeah.
exactly.
Predisposed to addictions.
Yeah. Okay, it's your turn.
Compliment and complement. There's compliment that's spelled complement versus compliment, complement. To compliment in the second sense, the PLI meant, it means to praise something. And to compliment in the first sense, PLEMENT, means to fill or complete. One of the most amusing little malapropisms I heard once was an empty compliment. And of course, the person meant to write compliment with a PLI, right? So it was like empty praise, right? But it came out as compliment with a PLE. And so it meant an empty thing that fills up. And I thought that was really unintentionally funny.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an awkward one. And I could understand people getting this wrong. I definitely think it's one that should be forgiven, but ideally try to get it right. Okay, another one that somebody asked me to address is on accident. And he said that it really, he can hardly stand to hear this when people say this. On accident. I actually haven't heard this, but the correct wording is by accident.
Yeah, I've never heard on accident. But yeah, it is definitely by accident. Another distinction that is often mixed up is continual and continuous.
Oh, yes.
So a continuous action is something that goes on without interruption, where something that's continual is like something that recurs over and over again. The neighbors have continual arguments, right? Meaning that they're having arguments over and over again. It doesn't mean that if you were to say the neighbors have continuous arguments, that means that they're always arguing, right? Your continuous misunderstandings, that is a bizarre idea. If somebody is always misunderstanding something, it is just as an unended, uninterruption, you know, if somebody has continuous misunderstandings, it goes on forever, right? But if they continually misunderstand something, it means that they do it over and over again.
I can tell you a rather ridiculous way that I remember this to get it right. And I thought of water like a waterfall, and it makes the S sound like that sound of water falling. Mm-hmm. And so that's continuous, because that waterfall is continuous. Right. So that was how I found it, mnemonic that I found to remember this.
That's actually really quite good. I like that. Yeah. So it would just be wrong to talk about, you know, it would be alarming if you had continuous misunderstandings, continuous arguments with your spouse.
it sounds like a hilarious
backplane. Yeah, can you imagine the, you know, I'm hearing the Curb Your Enthusiasm music going through my head, but it's perfectly possible to have continual misunderstandings, arguments, et cetera, and not be an idiot or a monster. You know, there's just these things happen over and over again. Continual misuse of continuous, right?
Yeah.
The continual misuse of continuous is far, far more forgivable than the continuous misuse of continual.
All right.
Excuse me. I'm being self-indulgent here.
All right. Another one that people ask me to address is similar to, different from, and different than. Now, generally, I think the rule here is that it should always be different from. Now, unfortunately, this sometimes leads to rather clumsy sentences. I did it differently than I did it before is easier than I did it differently from how I did it before, because then you've got to insert the word from. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be different from, and then similar to is because it's to and from, so it's opposites, so that's why it's similar to. I don't know what people say instead of that, similar as, similar with, and I'm not sure. But it should be similar to and different from.
Similar to, I generally use correctly. Different from, I don't necessarily always do. There's a small list of words that I continually use inappropriately. I sometimes misuse who and whom. I sometimes will end sentences with an of. You know,
Orwell said this in his essay about English: always break a rule rather than say something that sounds dreadful.
Yeah. And I know that sometimes I will say different than, but I can't think of a context where that sounds better. But yeah, sometimes it just sounds better. And so I'll just do it that way. Or, you know, to end a sentence with an of or a for or whatever. You're not supposed to do that. However, sometimes it's just the most direct way of speaking. And, you know, if you make it proper, it becomes flabby or loses its impact and all this. Yeah. So I just don't sweat those little things.
Yeah, exactly. I do have a few more. The country in which they came from, that's just bad. That's just bad. Examine that, and it's quite obviously wrong.
You just say the country they came from, or yes, the country from which they came. The latter is more proper, but the country they came from is simpler and more direct. And I wouldn't hesitate to say that.
Yeah, yeah. And then I've also seen people repeating that, like, the country from which they came from. I actually heard a politician saying that just the other day, probably about these refugees. So anyway,
it's like the worst line in the best song by Paul McCartney. In this ever-changing world in which we live in. And it's such a good song. It's Live and Let Die. And, you know, all he had to do was just elongate one of the syllables. This ever-changing world which we live in makes you give in and die. You know, but no, in which we live in. And somehow that got all the way through the recording process. George Martin didn't catch it. It's out there forever now, and it's become a classic.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay, and that will have encouraged people to make that error. Okay, self-sacrifice themselves.
It should be
sacrificed themselves, or they self-sacrificed. But self-sacrifice implies not so much that they sacrifice themselves, but that they sacrifice something. It's never self-sacrifice themselves. That's terrible. Yeah.
Oh, dilemma. Dilemma and also decimate are two words that are often misused. And they're misused because people don't know Latin. They've never studied Latin, and they don't know the literal meaning of these terms. So dilemma, people talk about, he faced a terrible dilemma. Should he go to Worms or Cologne or Aachen or Munich? Okay, he's facing something considerably worse than a dilemma if he's got four choices, right? Because dilemma really means a forced choice between two options.
It's like dimorphism.
The die means two, right? Dilemma. So it's really one choice or another. Right. It's dichotomous. Dilemmas are dichotomous. And so, but people will misuse dilemma, and they'll use it in a way that implies something far more complicated and more momentous than an actual dilemma, which is really a precise term that means literally having two choices.
So for more than that, you might just want to use quandary.
Yeah, yeah. Now, decimate is used in a similar way. To decimate literally means, well, deca means 10. When a Roman legion was mutinous, they would decimate it, meaning they would kill 1 out of 10 at random to punish them. And oftentimes people will use the word decimate to refer to something much worse than losing 1 out of 10, right? They'll say that the Mongol hordes decimated the city. Well, if only they decimated these cities, right? They did far worse than decimation, oftentimes. So it's pedantic maybe to do that. But, you know, these words have literal meanings. And if you know the literal meaning, then you won't use them in certain contexts. So I do think it's important to get things like that right. Dilemma is really two choices. Decimation is losing 1 out of 10. Now, you don't necessarily have to use it to just refer to 1 out of 10, but it's far less dramatic and destructive than the complete destruction, the massacre of an entire population or something like that. And so it shouldn't be used to refer to complete destruction.
Right. Okay. Yes, that definitely is how people use that, the word decimate. It means that the thing is devastated. It's pulverized. It's wrecked.
It's just punished. It's not destroyed. Yeah.
Yeah. I have one more here. I've written these examples. So racial characteristics are about more than skin color and extends to. Now, it should be extend to, because you're talking about something that is plural, characteristics. You're not talking about skin color, right? That's not the subject here. Or is it object? I get that mixed up. But either way, this is racial characteristics are about more than skin color and extend to. Now, similarly, my real life experience and observations of the world has taught me, it should be have taught me, because you're not talking about the world, you're talking about multiple observations and experience. So it's have. So you've got to think about what are you actually referring to in that second part of the sentence.
Right.
Very important.
Yeah, that's important. Yeah, definitely. Another thing that is often muddled up is the use of that and which. However, I don't really want to get into that.
Oh, God.
I don't want to get into which.
That reminds me of another one.
That
reminds me of another one, which is, and this, I'm afraid this is really an American thing, but now it has traveled across the Atlantic. It's saying that instead of who. And it makes my blood boil.
Yeah, when you're referring to people, you refer to them as who or whom.
I mean, there are content. I know that people don't mean any harm with this. It sounds awful. Please, if you can say who, if that would work in the sentence, just say it. Don't say that. You know, when you've got people that, I mean, I've seen sentences where it's like five that's.
Yeah, people that do this.
People that think that.
That refers to things, you know, and who refers to persons. And there's a difference between persons and things.
Yeah. I can't believe I didn't think of that one before. I didn't even write that one down, but it just came up because you mentioned which and that.
Mm-hmm. Generally, what happens is people overuse which. They will use which where they can use that. And therefore, the best way of proofing something, if you're proofing your writing, is to go on a witch hunt. If you can burn the witch, replace it with a bat, then you should do it. Because generally it's overused, I think.
Well, it's the same with who. Yeah. I think people default to saying that all the time. Yeah. So they don't need to distinguish. They don't need to think about whether it should be who or that. I think you're saying they should replace the which with that, but they should replace the that with who wherever possible.
Because oftentimes they're overusing that, or they're using that where they should be referring to people. People that love other people. Well, no, that's wrong. People who like people, right? People that like people are the best people in the world. That's a horrifying sentence to begin with, but then it's mutilated by sticking the that rather than a who in there.
Yeah, you're referring to people, so say who.
Yeah.
So yeah, there we go. Well, that's all of my notes. One thing I would say is, if you go to my Telegram channel and search for grammar, there's a way you can just magnifying glass symbol and search for grammar, you'll see an incredible range of polls that I set up a year ago to help you with. There are multiple options and you can choose which, and it will tell you which is the correct one.
Right.
So there are quite a few of that, about 10 or 15 of those. So that's something that people could do.
There are a couple others that come to mind. This is often done. People will say, I was very proud to see that he included me as a quote, right? Where it should be a quotation. Quotation is a noun and quote is a verb. But people often just use quote as a noun. Can you help me find the source of this quote? I hear that all the time.
So the website should be Wiki Quotation.
exactly. That's true. That's actually true. So what are a few other things? There are certain words that are commonly used now that have crept into ordinary language from computer programmers. So the word access. Access is a noun, or it used to be a noun. And now you routinely hear people saying, I'm trying to access this particular piece of information, right? Interface used to be a noun, and now it's a verb. There are different ways that our organization can interface with the public. I don't know if there's any way of stopping that because of bureaucracy and technocracy.
This is where you and I probably disagree, because I think that this doesn't do any harm. If people, if a noun becomes a verb, it's, and I know that Semiogog really hates this. He especially hates impact. It impacted our economy. It makes his blood boil. But I really don't mind it. That, I mean, I don't do it because I'm not young enough to have absorbed that. But I hear younger people do it, and I think, well, yeah, why not? It's useful. You gain access to something, you access it. I don't see the harm in this.
Yeah, yeah. Somebody in the chat, and let me be very clear, G-R-A-Y, Gray, says affect and effect. What's the difference? That's a good one.
That's complicated, because effect, effect can be used in both senses. Yeah. And affect has at least two different meanings. So it's difficult. Yeah.
Well, to affect means to influence, and to effect means to bring something about. That's one way of distinguishing it. So you can, I'm reading this from Christopher Lash. He has this little book called Plain Style. Voters' choices can effect minor changes and even affect major policy decisions. I think that's correct. They can effect them, meaning that they can actually create them. Yes, they can create minor changes, and they can affect, namely influence, major changes. So that is one way of distinguishing them. Yeah.
Then there's the effect of it was, that's another sense of effect.
Well, effect, it can be a noun, you know, and affect can be a noun too, but...
And then affected can be an adjective meaning faked, put on.
Yeah.
So, and then there's also the psychological word affect. So it's quite, I wouldn't blame anyone for getting this stuff wrong.
Yeah.
I've got to say, I'm very tolerant of this.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I do think that, you know, when you're talking about the verbs, affect means to influence and effect means to bring about. That is a distinction, and to say that, you know, the voters can effect minor changes and affect major ones, meaning they can actually bring about minor things and they can influence major things. They don't have the power to really bring about major things. It's kind of cynical, but it's actually realistic, you know. But yeah, those are okay. There's affect as a noun and as a verb, and effect as a noun and as a verb. And there are numbers of ways of getting those wrong. Yeah.
Yeah. And similarly, somebody has just messaged me and said hate as a verb and hatred as a noun, the distinction. But hate nowadays is also used as a noun. So he was purveying hate. I'm sure this has been said about you from time to time, Greg. I know it's been said about me. And hate monger. We are obviously a pair of hate mongers. I'd like to hope we're also grammar mongers at least. But technically, the correct term should be hatred mongers. So I guess I'll insist on that from now on. If you're going to say this about me, you've got to call me a hatred monger. Get it right. Whereas hate is traditionally a verb, meaning I hate this thing, I have hatred for it. So hatred is the noun.
Well, I'm trying to think if there are great English writers who use hate where you would be saying hatred. Immortal hate, right? Satan in Paradise Lost, he talks about his immortal hate.
Yeah,
I mean, I think he's referring to it as a thing.
Yeah, right? Yes, exactly. This isn't something that's a recent phenomena. I think it's been around for a long time. I know, I'm joking. It's been around for a long time. But I think that it was, traditionally, it was seen, it was almost always hatred was the noun. But hate was there. I've heard it. I've read it in old texts. So it is there.
Yeah. I'm always continually stunned by Milton. I was just looking at this quote, "The unconquerable will and study of revenge, immortal hate and courage never to submit or yield, and what is else not to be overcome." Of course, Satan is saying this. So, immortal hate. That's a great phrase. If it's good enough for Milton, it's good enough for me. I'm an immortal hate monger.
So Satan has good grammar, you're saying?
Yeah. If Satan said it, then it's good grammar, right?
That's a delightful quotation for Hope Not Hatred.
Yes, exactly. Apparently, the Quran is now the canon of Arabic grammar, whereas in its time, it was considered ungrammatical, right? And so these things can change.
Yeah.
Obviously. Yeah. If something is set up as the word of God, then how could God speak bad Arabic, right? So it became the canon.
Yeah. I mean, language does evolve. And I'm not against, I used to be more stick in the mud about this stuff. But nowadays, I think, no, it's okay. We don't need to hold on to these antiquated things just for the sake of it. It's all right for language to evolve. I just think that it should evolve properly, and hopefully not in a way that just degrades things pointlessly. Mm-hmm. It's structures should remain, I think.
Okay, so we have a couple of questions here. Our friend Gadius Maximus sends $10. Thank you very much. Reading a recent Goad piece, and I figured out I've been misspelling weather, W-H-E-T-H-E-R, as weather, W-E-T-H-E-R, for as long as I can remember. Also, homogeneous and homogeneous are different words, apparently. I have to say that I like homogeneous just because homogeneous sounds like milk. You know, so I want to talk about a homogeneous society, not a homogeneous society.
Well, it contains the word genius as well in its sound.
Yeah, genius, there's an extra E in there.
Of course.
It means the kind. But anyway, there's a person, and I'm forgetting her name. I'm very, very ashamed. She did these hilarious routines on Wagner. And she also did a thing about how to write your own Gilbert and Sullivan operetta. And she said that every Gilbert and Sullivan operetta must have a homogeneous chorus. And she says, it's homogeneous, not homogeneous, like milk. And so that always stuck with me. And I decided that I am going to stand for the homogeneous society, not the homogeneous one, like milk. So, and I hope that that's correct and it's not just pretentious. But anyway, that's how I do it. And I'm sticking with it. And I'm looking up the name of this woman because I'm very, very embarrassed not to remember her name. Okay, how to write your own Gilbert and Sullivan opera. It is by Anna Russell. That's who, Anna Russell. There's a CD I have. It used to be on vinyl, of course, the Anna Russell album, where she tells the story of the ring cycle. It's comedy, basically. It's musical comedy stuff. And her story on how to write your own Gilbert and Sullivan operettas, where I got first clued into the distinction between homogeneous and homogeneous like milk.
The only Gilbert and Sullivan song that I know is The Gondoliers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a really nice song, actually. There's quite a few performances of it on YouTube. And I first encountered it in the TV series Fall of Eagles, which I've talked about quite a lot on mm-hmm. my own channel. But it's a nice song. But anyway, that's a whole other topic.
Yeah. So Orpheus Victorious in the chat, what are your opinions on the sentences that start with and or but?
I don't mind them. I try to avoid them, but often it's simply the best, most effective way. And indeed, a couple of weeks ago, I wrote a Telegram post where the first three sentences were like that. And I looked at it and I thought, oh, am I letting the side down here? But I thought, no, it is actually the most effective way to do this.
Yeah.
So I just went ahead and did it.
Yeah, it's one of those things that good writers and bad writers do, right? Begin sentences with and, but, or. if you're a bad writer, it sounds awful. And if it's you're a good writer, you get away with it because you'll find a circumstance where it's really the best thing to do. It just works the best.
I don't think I've ever started a sentence with or, but certainly but. And is less common. It's rarely necessary or the most effective way. But absolutely, because you've said one thing and now you're going to give the other side of it. So you're going to contrast it with something else. So it makes sense. So you'd have to be. I mean, I'm not saying it's necessary to start the sentence with but. I'm just saying I don't think it's a crime.
It's not a crime. And sometimes it just works. If there's like a dramatic pause or something that you want to have there.
Of course.
You know, sometimes it just works. Or not. Right? Slog has donated 14 lemons. Thank you very much, folks. If you want to send your DLive tokens our way, we very much appreciate it. Thank you very much. So Cronin writes in, what about without further to do? No, it would be ado, right?
Yes.
Without further ado.
Oh, another one that's similar to that is I would never step foot on. It's set foot. You would never set foot.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I'd never heard that. But you see, one of the things
is it doesn't really matter at this stage. Either makes sense.
Stetfoot?
Stepfoot.
Stepfoot. Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Stepfoot on it. Yeah.
And another one that should be emphasized is the tenants and the tenants.
Yeah, that often comes up. You know, the basic tenets of white nationalism, and it's spelled like you're talking about the people who live in the white nationalist tenement, I guess, right?
Yeah.
The tenants. They're paying rent.
Yeah, tenants pay rent to a landlord. Tenets are principals.
Yeah. With a PLE, not a PAL.
Certainly, yeah.
Unless they're the first principals, can say they're principals.
There's another one. I should have mentioned this. If I would have, this makes my blood boil. And I couldn't believe when the film Doctor Sleep, I mean, it's everywhere now. And I watched the film Doctor Sleep, and the villain, who's supposed to be this very intelligent woman who's been around for centuries, she says it. And I remember thinking, this, like Kubrick in the original film, it just 1980, this would never have been said. Never.
Yeah.
The manager, Ullman, would never say this. Even Wendy wouldn't say it. Sorry to come out with another Shining reference. This is purely accidental. I'm only saying it because it's a really stupid character called Rose the Hat. And she says, if I would have. But I've mentioned that only to say that it's everywhere now. And it's awful. The correct thing is, if I had.
Yeah.
But even better than that is, had I.
Yeah.
If I would have gone there, had I gone there.
Yeah,
but
it's so much simpler.
It's simpler. It's half as the number of words. But I can understand people thinking that's a bit pretentious. But then, okay, say if I had gone there,
pretentious? Is it pretentious to use fewer words? You see, I don't think so. I think it's pretentious to use unnecessary words. Add useless syllables to words and things like that. That's pretentious. And the more simple the language, the less pretentious it is. However, the simpler the language, the more accomplished it is. Okay. You can try and become more and more accomplished, you know, and wanting to be more accomplished can be called a pretense, right? You're trying to better yourself. But when you better yourself in language usage, it's usually by making your language simpler and more correct at the same time. And so actually the most sophisticated speech is often the most simple speech because it communicates everything that it's trying to get across with the greatest economy.
Yes. I think that when you're a teenager, an adolescent, it's common and understandable. Try to master English or master the language by crafting complex sentences and really sort of showing off to yourself as much as anyone else. But once you get past that stage, you then realize actually economy is much better. And yeah. to use fewer words and simpler sentences is much better. Yeah, because you're creating unnecessary, what's called cognitive load by using unnecessarily complex sentences and more words than is necessary. Mm-hmm. So why do that?
So are there books or essays that you particularly recommend about writing and language usage in general?
It's a really cliched example, but the only one that I would recommend is Orwell's Politics and the English Language. It's very good. It's very interesting. It has a lot of interesting tips in it. And he was versed in both Latin and Greek, highly educated. So he knows far more about this than I do.
He's obviously a very fine writer, yeah.
Yes, and very good writer. Very effective. He's a good example of someone who writes very simple language, but very effectively. A couple of other examples that I looked at these polls that I wrote. It's deep-seated versus it's deep-seeded.
Oh, yeah.
The correct one is deep-seated, but I understand why people get it wrong and say it's deep-seeded because something is seeded. I understand, but the correct one is deep-seated. Another one is, now this is unfortunately increasingly common nowadays, the shop is ran by. Run. Yeah. The shop is run by. Mm-hmm. Ran is only the past tense of run. It's only mm-hmm. ever the past tense of run. So I ran the mile. Mm-hmm. But the shop is run by. Mm-hmm. The organization is run by, always. And then there are others that have drunk, have drank. Drank is only ever the past tense. Drunk can be he is drunk, or it can be he has drunk too much. He has mm-hmm. drunk 5 pints. He drank 5 pints. Mm-hmm. But it should never be he has drank 5 pints.
Right.
Never. I think that's all of them that I would want to mention. Yeah.
Well, there's a wonderful chapter in Paul Fussell's book, Class, A Guide Through the American Status System. It's chapter 7. It's called Speak That I May See Thee. And I recommend all countercurrents writers and prospective writers read that. And the whole book is really entertaining. Came out in 1983. My goodness, it's almost 40 years ago. But it's a wonderful book. It's very witty. And the chapter on language is superb. And basically, the lesson that you take away from this is that even America, which is in many ways a classless society, still has a class structure. And
it obviously does. It really annoys me how people go on it. It's obviously there. It's different from Britain.
Yeah.
It's not as, it's perhaps not as sharply defined, but it's absolutely there.
Yeah. You know, it's an overwhelmingly middle-class society, and that includes lots of very, very wealthy people who are very middle-class in their mentality. But there is an upper-class style, and there is a proletarian style. And one of the things that he observes is that upper-class and proletarian English in America actually converge in interesting ways, because proles are very frank about certain things, and so are rich people, whereas middle-class people, because they are anxious about their status, love euphemisms, and they love big words where small words will do. America is the country that gave us the restroom, because we don't like to speak about the toilet. It's too direct. Yeah. Rich people will say, where's your toilet? Poor people, proles will say, where's the toilet? Middle-class people, and that's the vast majority of Americans, will talk about the restroom. Oh, you need to take a rest. Where's your bathroom? Oh, you want to take a bath? They want to use euphemisms for anything that's connected with like sex and, you know, the body and stuff like that.
You know, yeah, I don't like mocking them for this. Maybe because I come from a middle class background myself, but also I think, look, if you don't have people being polite and perhaps overly polite, overly concerned with this stuff, if you don't have that, then society is just going to fall apart. I mean, this is part of what we're bemoaning here with this stream, that standards are falling precisely because the middle class no longer feel this duty.
Okay, this is less in terms of grammar, if you will, and more in terms of diction at this point. We're just talking about word choice. The thing that Fussell brings out is that middle-class people in America are status conscious and insecure, and they're constantly trying to signal with their language. And so they love to use euphemisms. And that's better, believe me, the amount of F-bombs that people drop today is appalling. And that is something that old middle-class squeamishness used to prevent, and to good effect, right? So there's a lot of prolish swearing now that's common in all classes of society, and the middle classes at least kept that out of their mouths, right? And the wealthy would only use it very, very sparingly and not in mixed company generally, but now it's everywhere. So that's definitely positive. But the main thing that comes out with Fussell is that middle-class people tend to use big words. They tend to use flashy words. They're trying to signal advertising. In America, advertising is a very middle-class thing because it uses words to appeal to status insecurity. Because so much of what's being sold with advertising is stuff that nobody needs. It's not being sold based on necessity. It's being sold based on status, right? Yeah. And middle-class people are far more status-conscious and insecure than the extremely wealthy or the extremely poor.
And this also speaks to why adverts now are really about woke morals, because the middle class are the ones who are susceptible to this stuff. They really
They're the strivers. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. The virtue signaling. And so that advertising is simply working with that.
Yeah.
And not for capitalistic purposes, but for, you know, changing society purposes.
Yeah. And there are people that, you know, I've edited before who they always betray their class. There's this one writer who comes from a very sort of almost affectedly lower class background, always wrote not with simple words, but with big $5 words where $1 words would do. And it was just like class anxiety, right? Trying to be flashy. And I would always edit that out because I thought, no. We want Countercurrents not to seem like a website full of insecure people who are trying to look smart. We want to have a crisp style that is, if you will, more upper class. Not because that's rich or something like that, but because it's freer. It's freer of status anxiety, freer of signaling, freer of advertising talk, and just more direct hang-ups and euphemisms. It's just the kind of discourse that you expect. And that's a very old notion of upper class, where the truly aristocratic person is frank, right, amongst his peers. Use simple words. You create an atmosphere where people can be frank with one another and speak the truth. That's sort of the feel that I want the website to have. And so I've tried to, you know, inculcate that just by editing writers to make things simpler. And I try and do that myself. I'm certainly not without sin. When you write about philosophy and when you get a PhD in philosophy, the worst thing about academia is the jargon, the pomposity, the insecurity that kind of writing creates. Academic writing is absolutely horrible.
And in that way, it's tailor-made for what you have nowadays, which is armies of black academics who aren't that bright but want to seem bright. And so there's this whole lexicon of long words that they can use.
It's
structural. oppression, discriminatory, etc. That it's really just buzzwords that they can just string together into a paragraph that then seems impressive.
A lot of it is empty. A lot of this is simply learned by osmosis. These people have no idea what these words mean or couldn't defend what these words mean. And it's barbarous, horrible linguistic junk. And this is what fills libraries now and fills the heads of college students. It's really a crime.
And the lack of clear language enables this obfuscation and brainwashing, ultimately, because people can't think clearly. They don't even know. Everything is being made more complicated or made to sound more complicated than it actually is. I mean, really, the whole thing. I remember scanning a page by bell hooks, and it was just endless long words. And in the end, what it amounts to is very, very little actual intellectual substance. It's just, well, blacks are being oppressed by whites, and that's it. That's really all that it's saying. But of course, that's obscured by the huge amounts of verbiage. And you see this all the time. I'm convinced that, and everyone says this all the time, really, that academia now is populated by midwits who don't actually have much to say. And what they do have to say is just stuff that they've absorbed from elsewhere. So it makes sense then that they would want to obscure that by using as many words as possible.
Yeah, yeah. Hapa Perspective has donated one lemon to us. Thank you very much. Is Homer Simpson middle class or working class?
He's a Jewish notion of what white men are like.
Yeah, that's pretty good. But I mean, does he have a lunch bucket? If he's got a lunch bucket, he's working class. If he goes to work with a tie on and has lunch in restaurants, then he's middle class. It's been a long time since I watched The Simpsons. You know, The Simpsons have been going for how many decades now?
I think it was 1989. It's quite astonishing.
And it sucked for more than 20 years.
Yeah, I haven't watched it for, at least 20 years. Yeah. That's a whole other topic. But yeah. I'm pretty sure that the Simpsons are supposed to be, well, in Britain, they would be called a working class family.
Yeah.
Maybe in America, that would, I don't know. But Homer Simpson is not supposed to be educated. At all. And he's not supposed to be bright. He's an idiot.
Yeah, yeah. You know, he's an idiot. And he's such an idiot that you can't imagine him, frankly, actually being a human being. You know, he's a contemptuous, poisonous caricature. And the whole show is a contemptuous, poisonous caricature by urbanites of white Americans. Gröning, who created it, is not Jewish. His wife is. And he's a Hollywood urbanite. Of course, he's checked out of it a long, long time ago. I don't think he has much control over it. It was actually genuinely funny for a while. It's actually brilliant for a long time. But then it just became, you know, at a certain point, I realized the characters aren't the same and this isn't funny. And I stopped glancing at it.
I just Googled that. And the description immediately when you put in The Simpsons, the description is working class Homer Simpson.
Right.
I didn't mention class. That's just what came up immediately. Uh-huh. I'm surprised that Matt Groening isn't Jewish, because the whole, I would guess that the writing team, because I know it had huge numbers of writers, I would guess that it was dominated by a certain tribe, because I mean the attitude to white America is
contemptuous, basically. Dan writes in with $5. Thank you. I would like your opinion on the pronunciation of formidable. So I think you got my opinion that way.
Yes, I always say formidable, but I've heard formidable said by people who are, you know, educated. So I'm guessing it's either or.
I've heard it both ways, frankly. And I probably pronounced it both ways. There's a little appendix in Lash's Plain Style book of words that are often mispronounced. And yeah, he was writing this for his graduate students, right? And one of the things that happens if you are genuinely self-motivated, an autodidact, right? A person
self-starter.
A self-teacher, is you read a lot and you don't necessarily hear words pronounced. And then you find that you pronounce them and you pronounce them wrong. I remember, I think I was like 9 years old or 8 years old, and I pronounced the word catastrophe, and my mother smiled and corrected me, and I thanked her for that. But I hear people all the time in their 20s routinely mispronouncing words because they've never heard it before, and it's not because they have poor vocabularies, it's just that they get everything from reading, and oftentimes they just don't hear it correctly pronounced. And I've made lots of mistakes like that myself over the years, and I'm just grateful to be corrected.
I think this is a casualty of, well, the way we live now. It's also, people don't go to, like, educated, intelligent people don't go to a university with a lecturer and the lecturer uses rare words. That doesn't really happen anymore. Also, television has fallen by the wayside. So intelligent people will seek out material online, which is usually written rather than spoken.
Yeah.
It definitely happens, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So a few words that he has is anyway rather than anyways.
That's an American colloquialism, isn't it? Anyways.
Anyway. Congratulations, not congratulations.
Again, that's another American thing. So, yeah. I think I put this up as a poll on at some point, because I was wondering about this. Some Americans say congratulations.
No, and you know where that comes from?
I actually find it quite nice. It's sweet. But anyway, go on.
It comes from the Dutch. It comes from the Dutch settlers in New York, because the Dutch don't pronounce the TH the way the English people do. And so, you know, in New York City, you'll hear New Yorkers, they'll say not 33rd Street, but Toid Street.
Oh dear.
And it's very funny.
I wouldn't associate that with Dutch.
Well, but
I would associate it with another group that's in New York.
Well, yeah, but it's interesting that I'm told, and I could be wrong, but I'm told that New Yorkish pronunciation, where the THs are does, is rooted in the original Dutch settlement of New York. Could be wrong, wow. But that's what I've heard. And so congratulations, it might be that influence again. But yeah, it's congratulations. Et cetera, not et cetera. I hear espresso. I've always said espresso. Evidently is derived from evidence. So it'd be evidently, not evidently. But yeah. I've heard it both ways. I've probably said it both ways. And sometimes in just the music of language, you if you have the option of shifting the emphasis, sometimes it just sounds better. Exquisite, accented on the first syllable, not exquisite. You know, things like that. Thief, people actually pronounce thief like rhyming knife. Fife, okay. Flaccid. Lasted.
Fiefdom. Yes, I have heard that. Sorry, go on.
Fiefdom, yeah. Fiefdom. Flaccid, not flaccid or flaxseed, as he says.
There's another word like that.
Yeah.
Is it succession? Grubble,
you know, to grovel. He says is proper, not grovel. I thought that's very interesting. I've always heard it as grovel. His groveling assistant, but apparently it's supposed to be groveling. Isn't that interesting? And I don't know why that is. Inherent, not inherent. Inherent. That's just sort of hearing, literally hearing. No pun. The roots, but inherent. Laissez-faire, not laissez-faire. Luxury, not luxury. luxury. It just sort of you swish it around in your mouth because, well, it's luxury, you know. That's advertising talk, I think.
I was going to say, it sounds like an 80s advert.
Yeah, exactly. Mischievous, not mischievous.
I don't know. I'm much less bothered by these pronunciations. It's actual grammatical errors that really annoy me.
Yeah. You know, I've heard Nietzsche's name spelled or pronounced Nietzsche.
Yes, I used to do that. Until somebody pointed it out. Yeah. But it was back at the start of my channel.
Herbert Marcuse, not Marcuse. I mean, that's basically treating German language, pronouncing German names like they're German names. However, I do like the sturdy ethnocentrism of the English who will pronounce French words as if they're not French. you hear that in Canada. Anglo-Canadians will pronounce French words as if they're English words. I think it's just a resentment that their French words are there at all. Or Texans will say hola, you know. they're appropriating the Spanish language. They're not going to speak it with the Spanish accent. So I can understand that. Sometimes you take words and make them your own. One word that even American presidents are constantly failing to pronounce properly is nuclear.
Oh, George Bush with the nuclear.
Nuclear, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, a special papal dispensation, not papal. The papacy, so anyway, there or vice versa, not vice versa, but these are
I think the Italian is it vice versa?
Exactly. I mean, somebody raised the question, is it Medici or Medici? I need to look that up.
Yeah,
because I actually think the French who did, have a Marie. Actually had a queen. It was the Medici. I think they pronounce it Medici, but I've been meaning to check that. Sometimes you take a word and you make it your own and it sounds wrong to pronounce it correctly. You know?
Yes.
So
yes.
In English, we talk about Munich. We don't say München, right? So
whenever I see Medici, it reminds me of Videodrome. rather than the historic family, I know about them, but my first reference is Videodrome because the villainous corporation is called Medici in that film.
That's interesting. I'd forgotten that. I've only seen Videodrome once a very long time ago. Well, we have been going at this for 2 hours. I didn't think this would go on so long, but I think it's been very enjoyable and I hope helpful. We're trying to cultivate our movement to make us all more effective communicators.
Absolutely.
And verbal.
Yeah. And I would reiterate what I said at the start, that this stuff might seem overly fussy to you. That's a matter of opinion. Everyone will have their own yardstick for this stuff. But it does make you sound more articulate, more educated, and frankly, more intelligent, because that's just the inference that people take when they hear good grammar. So I guess some people would say, well, I don't care about sounding intelligent. I think some people are quite defensive about this, that they'll say, well, I am intelligent, so I don't need to worry about sounding intelligent. But actually you do, because these things, the outward appearance of something will affect how people perceive it, and therefore how they will treat it and how they will regard it in their minds, how they will speak of it to other people. So this stuff does matter. And I hope we've catalogued quite an incredible range of errors here. So I hope this has been useful to people.
Yeah, I think we should do this again. It would be fun to talk through something like that wonderful Orwell essay or the Fussell chapter on language, because they're filled with wonderful examples and they're entertaining. They're very well written. And I really learned a lot, especially from Fussell. I think he is an amazing figure. And he helped me eliminate advertising talk from my vocabulary. Advertising creeps in everywhere. We're just inundated in it. We're marinated in it. You know, we're constantly bombarded by it. And yes.
And it impacts our vocabulary.
It does. It impacts us. Yes, exactly. So I hate it now. I cringe now when people talk about cocktails. You know, you want a drink, you know, a cocktail. You know, it's supposed to sound fancy and sophisticated. It just sounds like an advertisement to me.
Again, it just takes me straight back to the 80s. My mind goes straight to the, like, yuppies, and Bob Morton. Indeed. Now, one thing that somebody has asked me just at the last minute here, they asked me a while ago, but I didn't see it. The distinction between hanged and hung. I'm never quite sure about this. I think it is that somebody was hanged, and otherwise the past tense is hung, I believe.
You know, I've always heard, he was hanged put it this way. He was hung means something very different than he was hanged.
Yeah.
I'll just leave it at that. So it's a distinction that you want to carry around, because otherwise people might think the wrong things about you, right? some people have written some amusing things in the chat over at Odyssey. Thank you, folks. I don't want to be a pretentious jerk off. I wipe my arse with all of my degrees. What a waste of $15. And I just thought that was funny.
Very good.
Yes. Anyway, I thought that was good. So we have gotten Norse Nature has donated 3 ice cream to us, Happa Perspective 3 lemons, Slog 28 lemons. That's very generous. Thank you very much. Folks, we're going to wrap this up. I will be back on Saturday for the regular Countercurrents Radio live stream. I haven't decided who's on yet. I've been sort of weighing different options for who should come on the live stream as the guest in the first hour. And in the second hour, I'll probably just do an AMA, which I very much enjoy. And of course, this weekend on Sunday, we will also have the Writer's Block with our friend and host Nick Gilvey. So come back this weekend, and we will have many more hours of Countercurrents Radio. So Woz, thanks so much. And how do people follow your work?
Well, there is millennialwoz.com. There is the Telegram channel. There is the Odyssey channel. And there's Gab. And I should say Millennial has 2 L's and then another, 2 N's and then another L at the end. That's how to spell it. It's all the consonants that you could possibly want are in there. So if people get that wrong, they'll spell it with 1 N or whatever. So they might end up in the wrong place. So that's how to find me.
Great. Well, it has been a pleasure. It's always a pleasure. And did I say it has been a pleasure? Yes, that's what I meant. I didn't say it is been a pleasure. It has been a pleasure. It always is. And I look forward to the next time we do an episode of Countercurrents Radio. So thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me on. And I hope everyone benefited from this.
I learned something from it. I enjoyed it. And I appreciate all you listeners out there, especially the donators, even our moderators. We've had, they snapped into action to help out. It was just sort of a last minute whim to do this stream, but we got a respectable audience, and I really, really appreciate it. So thank you all. And we will be back on Saturday.